You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some recent research shows that getting more deep sleep can help reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's. We'll dig into what that says and find out some other ways we can help prevent the disease coming up.
Now, Britney Spears says she wants to end a legal arrangement that's given her father, Jamie Spears, control over much of her life for more than a decade.
The legal arrangement is called a conservatorship or guardianship in some states, and many advocates say that arrangement can leave people vulnerable to abuse.
Britney Spears testified in court last week saying that her conservatorship had been abused. Among other things, she said she's been forced to stay on birth control to prevent her from having another child. Here's some of what she told a Los Angeles judge in some leaked testimony.
The last time I spoke to you, by just keeping the conservatorship going and also keeping my dad in the loop, made me feel like I was dead. Like I didn't matter. Like nothing had been done to me. Like you thought I was lying or something. I'm telling you again because I'm not lying. I want to feel heard. And I'm telling you this again so maybe you can understand the depth and the degree and the damage that they did to me back then. I want changes, and I want changes going forward. I deserve changes.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been involved in a conservatorship or guardianship, maybe as a conservator or as a conservatee? If so, what was that experience like for you? Have you been following the news about Britney Spears and her legal fight? If so, what do you make of it, and what questions do you have about how these arrangements work? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Rebecca Diller is a clinical professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. She's an expert in conservatorship, elder law, and disability law. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So conservatorship might not be something that immediately comes to mind for a lot of people. Can you walk us through the basics of what it is and how conservatorships actually work?
Sure. So conservatorship is a process that takes place in state courts, and it's a process by which an adult can be declared incapable of making their own decisions and lose the rights to make really fundamental choices about their lives, choices that include where to live, who to spend time with, what health care to receive, and also the ability to access and decide how to spend one's own money. Once a conservatorship is established, the power to make those decisions gets transferred into the hands of the conservator. And that could be a person, like in Britney Spears' case, for a long time it was her father. It can also be an agency. But once the conservatorship is established, the conservator really has an extraordinary amount of power and control over the person's life. And in theory, it's a pretty high standard to establish a conservatorship. The court needs to find that the person is facing some sort of significant harm due to limitations in their ability to make or communicate decisions, and that no less restrictive alternative is available. But what we find in practice is that often conservatorship is used too readily. It's put in place for too long and with too many powers granted to the conservator.
So really quickly, to look at who is typically put under a conservatorship, you know, some of it's decision making, but who was this originally put in place for?
So there, you know, often one thinks about three groups of folks who get affected by conservatorship. One would be younger people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and their parents are often advised to create a conservatorship when they turn 18. Another group that is often affected by conservatorship is older adults with cognitive impairments like dementia, and then also people with mental health disabilities often find themselves subject to conservatorship. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, you know, one of the big challenges we have in talking about conservatorship in the U.S. is that the system is fraught with a lot of problems. And one of them is that we don't have good data on any of it. So there's the best estimate is that 1.3 million people across the country are under some kind of conservatorship or guardianship, but we don't have good data that like will tell us, you know, how many people are under it for which reason and for how long. And it's really alarming because when you think about the enormous power that conservators have and the vulnerability that people face once they're under conservatorship, you know, it's quite alarming that we don't have a better handle on exactly how many folks are affected and what's going on in each of their cases.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that it's something that isn't more closely monitored, especially because it does seem like something that in theory and in practice feels like it has the best intentions, but if there are that many potential flaws, you know, why hasn't there been any sort of intervention or monitoring of it?
Yeah, so there have been actually, I would say in the last 40 years, there have been a number of efforts to reform conservatorship and guardianship, but they've fallen short for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that there's just not enough resources within the state court systems to monitor conservatorships in the way that they should be monitored. That's been one problem. Another problem is that it's sort of an insulated practice world in most states, and it's not subject to that much public scrutiny. And until there's a big scandal, nobody really thinks about it. You know, and then the other problem is that the people who are under conservatorship face enormous hurdles in bringing problems to the attention of the court system and the public, because once you're under a conservatorship, you don't have access to to some of your basic information, things like your healthcare records, things like your financial records. You can lose access to that information. So it makes it even harder to kind of bring problems to the attention of a court.
We are talking to Rebecca Diller right now. She's a clinical professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law. And we are talking right now about conservatorship, what it is, because it's in the news right now because of the high profile case involving Britney Spears. Now, really quickly, since we are using Britney Spears as an example right now, you know, about 13 years ago, she did have, you know, a couple of very public mental health crises. And that was about the point when her family stepped in to establish this conservatorship. It's been 13 years. Not to be an armchair psychologist here, but she has been working pretty readily. I think some people would say it seems like she feels a little healthier. But, you know, the judge just denied her request. How frequent is it that, you know, when people, once they even learn that they can petition to be let out of their conservatorship, are denied?
Yeah, so that's an enormous problem within conservatorship. It's very hard to undo once it's established. So here you have a person like Britney Spears, who, you know, has been judging reality shows. She's been on tour. She's had albums released. I mean, she is, it's very hard to believe that she's under conservatorship and that she continues to be under conservatorship. And part of the challenge is that, you know, once it's imposed, people under conservatorship really face high hurdles to getting a court to end the conservatorship. And part of that is just part of it's the way the law is written, but part of it is just more fundamentally reluctance by courts to end these arrangements. And I think that's an area that really has got to be subject of more reform, because it shouldn't be as difficult as it is to end a conservatorship.
And sticking with the Britney Spears case, you know, she has alleged that she had to basically forfeit her passport and her credit cards, and that she's also been forced to keep an IUD within her body to prevent her from having another child. You know, people were shocked to hear things like this, but is it more commonplace than maybe we realize?
You know, her statement last week, I think, should trouble all of us, both because some of what she said, you know, appears to be illegal and abusive under the law, and some of it actually isn't and is fairly commonplace and should be changed. So, you know, the fact that she's talked about being forced to continue to use an IUD when she doesn't want to was really, you know, evocative of some of our worst treatment of people with disabilities in this country's history. You know, there's a terrible record of depriving people of their fundamental rights to choose when and whether to have children based on disability. And so the fact that she is experiencing this right now was incredibly shocking and troubling. And, you know, the court really needs to take that quite seriously and do something about it right now. The thing that she talked about with regard to not having access to her passport and her credit cards, you know, that's actually rather common. I have seen that in my clinic's work. And the problem with that is, imagine how can you establish any kind of foothold on doing anything independently in your life without access to your basic ID, without access to any kind of credit card to spend as you would like. You know, and this is her money, of course, that she's trying to access. So that actually is somewhat more commonplace, you know, speaks of one of the problems that many people under conservatorship face.
We are talking to Rebecca Diller right now. She's a clinical law professor at the Cardoza School of Law, and she's with us right now to talk about what conservatorships are and how they work. We're talking about this after Britney Spears alleged in court last week that her father is abusing a conservatorship that she's been under for 13 years.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in a conservatorship on any part of that process? Do you think the system works well, or do there need to be changes? Have you been following the news about Britney Spears? Is this the first time you heard about this idea of conservatorship? What questions do you have of what you're seeing in the news? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are continuing our conversation about Britney Spears and conservatorships, how they work, and ideas for reforming them. Rebecca Diller stays with us from the Cardozo School of Law. But I want to add another voice to this conversation right now. We have Anna Krieger. She is a senior attorney for the Center for Public Representation, and she advocates for an alternative to conservatorship called supported decision making. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why do you think we should be looking for alternatives to conservatorships?
Well, I think obviously Britney Spears has shined a light on this issue in a way that no one really has before. And it's showed everyone that there's the system in place and there are flaws in it. You know, the flaws can take a number of forms. There can be, you know, abuses of guardianship, or there can just be cases where people are put under a guardianship or a conservatorship and it's just not necessary. They could make their own decisions if they had a different set of tools and assistance in place. And that's where supported decision making comes in as an alternative.
And can you talk about what supported decision making is?
Sure. So supported decision making might be a new term, but it's actually something very familiar. It's really based on how everyone makes decisions every day. folks using SDM supported decision making choose people that they trust to be part of a group or a network of supporters who will help them with decision making. And so those supporters help the individuals understand the decisions before them, whether it's a choice about maybe their medical care and whether to have surgery or take a new kind of medication. They'll help explain the decision in a way that the person can understand, and then the person can express their will and preferences and say, this is what I want, because they've been given the information and they can really make a choice for themselves. And then the supporters might also assist the individual with communicating that decision to third parties, like the healthcare provider in that example. So it's really an opportunity for people to retain their decision-making rights. They don't have a third party like a guardian or a conservator who's making the choice for them. They remain the decision-maker. They're just getting support that allows them to make their own decisions.
So supported decision-making feels like something, as you said, that we all do. And one thing Rebecca brought up in our earlier conversation was that parents frequently become conservators, or they're encouraged to become conservators or guardians for their children, once they reach adulthood and they might have, mental health issues, anything like that. Do you think that people, parents, guardians, just might not be aware that supported decision making is available to them?
Yes, yes, yes. It's really common that people say, oh, I didn't know about this model. You've just described what we've been doing in our family for our whole lives. And you're telling me I can do this way, and I could kind of, we usually have folks write it up in a formal kind of written agreement that's very simple and straightforward. And for a lot of families, it's like a light bulb turning on. You know, this is a reflection of how we do things already. And they're often getting messages from school districts, from other institutions that are telling them, this is, you need to protect your child. You need to have a guardianship in place. When actually, it's a much better protection for the child to practice making their own choices, to maintain their autonomy. And then they become more independent. They become more self-sufficient. All of those things are a huge benefit to the individual. So a lot of times families are pursuing this just out of lack of awareness of, a lot of times people will pursue the guardianship or the conservatorship out of a lack of awareness of other options that could get them to the same place in a better way.
So this is a much less restrictive model. Do you see any growing movement for more families or people to pursue supported decision making?
Absolutely. You are so lucky to be in, for all the folks in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin actually has a law that advocates worked extremely hard to get in place. That's the supported decision-making law. And folks at the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities have developed a whole toolkit to promote supported decision-making. And you can access that through our website or their website. You can go to supporteddecisions.org and find your way there. And that toolkit helps people just get set up with a supported decision-making arrangement. So the fact that there's a law already in place in Wisconsin is a huge benefit. It means that courts are supposed to be considering whether a supported decision-making arrangement would be a less restrictive alternative before they put anyone under a guardianship in Wisconsin.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Anna Krieger. She is a senior attorney for the Center for Public Representation. She was with us today to talk about supported decision making, the model of that as an alternative to conservatorship. And we are still with Rebecca Diller. She's a clinical professor of law at Cardozo School of Law. Rebecca, we just learned about this supported decision making. How does this work into the overall court system?
Well, courts should be considering two things. One is, before imposing any kind of conservatorship or guardianship, when they're looking at whether a person's able to make decisions, they should be looking at whether the person could make decisions if they had the type of support that Anna just talked about. So it's a less restrictive alternative, and it really should be considered and tried before any conservatorship is put in place. And then second of all, now that it's emerging as this very promising alternative, courts should be looking at people who already have conservatorships and considering whether or not those conservatorships could end if the person were to put in place a supported decision-making arrangement. So it's a wonderful alternative that, as Anna said, really actually describes what a lot of people are already doing in practice within their families. But giving it more legal recognition is a way to avoid unnecessary conservatorships.
You know, is there a time and a place where a conservatorship is just absolutely necessary?
You know, there are, you know, a number of circumstances where it's probably unavoidable. But my concern is always that we have to really try much harder to exhaust every other alternative. You know, I just don't see that happening in the way it should be happening right now. But, you know, there are some circumstances where, you know, there's probably, it just might be unavoidable, but those are far more limited than what we see going on right now. And also when those can happen, it's important that courts also limit the powers that are given to a conservator. For example, one thing we find happening a lot is that conservators are given broad powers over, you know, finances, healthcare, who the person spends time with, when really a much more narrowly tailored type of court intervention could solve the problem that has brought this into court in the first place.
We have about 15 seconds left, but with Britney Spears' high profile case, do you think that there's enough attention on it to maybe change things?
You know, there is more attention certainly than we've seen in recent years as a result of Britney Spears' case. And I hope that when people think about her case, they think about not just her, but all the other people who don't have the kind of exposure, fame, and money that has garnered this kind of attention. I hope we think about all the other people under conservatorship as well.
That was Rebecca Diller. She's an expert on conservatorship, and we were talking about it in light of Britney Spears. You're listening to Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up at 6, it's 1A+. China celebrates 100 years of communist rule. Jen White's Friday News Roundup guests include a reporter who was there to see Beijing roll out the red carpet this week. That's ahead tonight at 6 on 1A+.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we talked with some doctors about the controversy surrounding a newly approved drug aimed at treating Alzheimer's.
There are questions about the effectiveness of that drug, and Alzheimer's has proved to be a difficult disease to treat, but there are some things we can do that can help prevent it.
Some recent studies say that deep sleep, the kind when dreams are rare and your body temperature drops, can help protect us from Alzheimer's disease.
Researchers have known for a long time that poor sleep can lead to long-term problems with memory and thinking. Now they're starting to connect the dots between sleep and dementia, especially Alzheimer's.
Sleep is just one piece of the puzzle. Our next guest says there are many health behaviors that can lower our risk of developing Alzheimer's.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about getting Alzheimer's? Does it run in your family? What kind of activities do you do to keep your mind engaged? What questions do you have about Alzheimer's prevention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Dr. Nathaniel Chin is a geriatrician and the medical director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Program at UW-Madison. He's the host of the Dementia Matters podcast, and he's an assistant professor of medicine, geriatrics, and gerontology in UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Chin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to prevention, can we talk about why prevention is so important? Alzheimer's seems like a really difficult disease to actually treat.
And that's one of the reasons why I think prevention is so key. We are having a very difficult time, not only in understanding Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline, but then in having therapeutics and treatments to stabilize or reverse cognitive decline.
With prevention, as I understand it, there's not one magic thing we can do. But that said, before we get into specific prevention elements, how much can we do to lower our risk of Alzheimer's? How big a difference can we make?
I think it's quite significant. There are a lot of studies out that show that 35% of cases of dementia, which isn't specific to Alzheimer's, but is what we see in people, 35% of those are potentially modifiable. And so that's a huge area for us to have an empowering impact on.
Are some people more at risk of developing Alzheimer's or even other forms of dementia than others?
Yes, certainly people can have a genetic risk factor that isn't going to determine that you have Alzheimer's disease, but would increase your risk. And certainly things that happen early in your life that you may not have control over can increase your risk for future cognitive change.
All right, well, let's dig a little bit into what we can do. I just referenced some research on sleep, for example. How big a difference can sleep be in our risk of dementia?
I'm glad you referenced that one in particular, because I think that's an underappreciated lifestyle habit. We often live in a culture where you're proud to not get much sleep and tough it out. But the reality is most of us need 7 to 8 hours of sleep, and it is really important for us. We can feel the effects of not having proper sleep. And so it is not only a risk factor in the development of the proteins of Alzheimer's disease, as well as future cognitive decline. But science is starting to show that it's a possible mechanism for how we build up these abnormal proteins of Alzheimer's when we don't get enough sleep or a deep enough sleep.
We've had conversations on this show with sleep specialists on how we can boost our chances of sleep. It's not an easy thing. It's not as easy in some ways as, you know, eating more veggies or something like that that we'll get into. How important, if we've got problematic sleep, is it for us to seek out help in solving our sleep problems?
I think it's worth stopping what you're doing and reaching out, first through your primary care provider or even just through the internet and searching for sleep hygiene techniques. And a lot of our sleep issues are behaviors that we have and routines that we have during the day that lead to a difficult time sleeping. Not all of them, but a lot of times we can improve our own sleep just with some helpful techniques.
Talking to Dr. Nathaniel Chin with the Alzheimer's Disease Research Program at UW-Madison, talking about Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia and choices we can make, things we can do in our lives to help lower the risk. Not one magical solution, but some things that can tip the odds in our favor. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your questions about Alzheimer's, about prevention in particular, if you have changed your life in some way with some of these things in mind, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Chin, how about diet and exercise? We hear about these as things we can do to influence a lot of our health outcomes. How does it fit into Alzheimer's?
Those are the other two really critical ones. So exercise is pretty incredible what it can do, not only for our heart, but our brains. When you exercise aerobically in particular, you actually can alter the genes that are being activated or inactivated in our body. And in particular, you can increase the production of a protein in your brain called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That protein helps you grow more brain cells or keep your brain cells healthy, as well as the connections between brain cells. And so, but it's also just about blood flow, improvement to your mood, improvement to your musculoskeletal system. The exercise alone has a huge impact on how our heart and our brain function.
The good news there is, A, there's not a lot of downside to getting more exercise and eating better. And even if it's only a small effect on Alzheimer's, we know it has a lot of benefits for cardiovascular health, stroke prevention, that kind of thing. So there's nothing wrong with doing those things.
There's no downside other than you might feel tired afterwards or you could have some sore joints. But in truth, it's only the upside. And you don't have to do a lot of it. Even 10 minutes to start out is something that is quite meaningful for your wellness, but also for your brain.
And for, on the diet side of things, what are some really simple things that we can try to work into our daily or at least weekly food routines?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about diet. Diet is one of the hardest ones, but yet one of the most important lifestyle changes that we can make. The MIND diet, which is M-I-N-D, is a specific type of diet created at Rush University, as our colleagues in Illinois. And it really does focus on Mediterranean, heart-healthy, low-salt, but also things like blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, things that have antioxidants in them. To answer your question, dark green leafy vegetables are really key. The berries are really key, and healthy fats are really key.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Black River. John, hi.
Hey, I just had a question. I thought I'd listened to another podcast where they had talked about a compound called rapamycin. And I was just wondering what the effect that has on prevention, taking it before you'd be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
John, thanks for the call. That's a medication, I think, Dr. Chin, that there have been studies on that anyway. What do we know?
So that's an excellent question. That's actually at the heart of a lot of aging and longevity research. So rapamycin is a medication that people use for specific medical conditions. It's also used in scientific studies in looking to see if we can lengthen a person's, not only their chronological age, but just the health of a person. As a geriatrician, of course, I'm always very conscientious of medications, of side effects. And so it isn't something where we're ready to start recommending to people that you take this as a preventative. But certainly it helps us explain mechanisms of why some people might be aging slower, or they might be living a more active life throughout their life compared to other people. So it's a very hot area of research. And I do think there's something to it. So I think there's more to come. And our own scientists here at UW are looking at this as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, John. We'll go to Olivia now in Eau Claire. Olivia, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Olivia?
So I know you guys were just talking about the effects of sleep on dementia and Alzheimer's, and I was just wondering if prolonged overnight shift working has, a prevalence in an increase in dementia.
Oh, interesting, Olivia. Thanks for that question. Dr. Chin, do we know?
Olivia, I love the question. I myself do night shifts at the hospital, and so I've been asking that question as well. There isn't a lot of studies looking at night shift workers or persistent or many nights in a row of sleep and how that affects cognition. There is some evidence that a disrupted night of sleep, just one, can lead to cognitive changes just for the next day or the day after that. We don't know that that's permanent. We certainly can feel that when we have a bad night's sleep, or for people who do shift work, they can feel off the next day or the few days before they recover. And so I think that's an area that needs more understanding. And it really does highlight the circadian rhythm and this idea of deep sleep, which is sometimes harder when you're trying to go to bed at 8 a.m.
Thanks a lot for the question, Olivia. We are talking about the best ways to reduce our risk of developing Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Nathaniel Chin. He's a geriatrician and medical director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Program at UW-Madison. You can learn a lot more on his podcast. It's called Dementia Matters.
And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What kinds of things do you do to keep Alzheimer's at bay? Do you exercise and eat well? What do you do to keep your mind sharp? And what questions do you have about Alzheimer's and hopefully preventing it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about preventing Alzheimer's right now. Last month, we had a couple of doctors on to talk about the controversy surrounding the FDA's approval of a new drug for the disease. Today, we're focusing on what we can do to lower our risk of developing it.
Dr. Nathaniel Chin stays with us. He's a geriatrician and medical director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Program at UW-Madison, also the host of the Dementia Matters podcast.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you do to keep your mind sharp, or if you have any questions about keeping Alzheimer's at bay. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org.
And let's go back to our callers now. Philip is with us in Monroe. Philip, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What you want to
talk? My wife and I are both part of the core study group at the ADRC UWF. I've been part of Connecto and a couple of the other projects that have had all the scans. So I'm going out to Stanford University. I'm on route now to participate in a study with electromagnetic pulse for treatment of mild cognitive impairment. And my question to the doctor is, has he heard of this, and what's he think?
Philip, thanks for the call. He's going to Stanford University for, he said, electromagnetic pulse therapy. Are you familiar with this, Dr. Chen?
I have heard of it. And of course, coming out of Stanford, you know that it's gone through the proper channels to get to the point where we can start studying that on human beings. And so I trust that they're following the right protocols. I don't know a ton about the underlying mechanism for how they think that's helpful. But there is some small studies, particularly in animals, where they show that that is a way of somehow eliminating that first protein in particular of Alzheimer's disease called amyloid. And so I think what your caller is suggesting, though, is that we really have to be open to multiple different ways of addressing the pathology, the changes of Alzheimer's disease in the brain. And coming up with these very creative ways like this is something that, in addition to potentially a medication, could be needed down the road. So I appreciate the participation in our center, as well as the one over in Stanford.
Philip, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck with that treatment. Dr. Chen, getting back to some of the things we know about prevention, I always hear, intellectual activity, keeping your brain working and stimulated. How effective is that for prevention, and what kind of things are we talking about here?
It does seem to be effective at reducing risk. And our center, as well as many of our colleagues across the country, do have lots of what we call association studies. So we're not trying to prove that A causes B, but we see a relationship between people who engage in stimulating activities. That could be card games, playing music, reading, writing, artwork. And then later on in our studies, showing that they tend to have slower decline or improved memory on some tests, or just a lower risk of developing dementia. And so it's certainly a reasonable and hopefully a fun way of not only keeping active, but then doing something good for the future version of yourself.
As you mentioned, we don't know about the causality here. How do we sort out whether the activity itself prevents development of dementia versus the sort of people who engage in those activities are for some reason less prone to dementia?
That's one of the million-dollar questions. And it's really difficult to do that, not only because the study itself would be quite intense, mm-hmm. but it would take a long time in observing people for one intervention for a long period of time. And so I think it really speaks to likely there are multiple things happening. When we engage our brains, oftentimes we're doing it with other people. So there's a social aspect. So that might make us feel better and improve our mood and reduce our stress. So there's probably other components to it. But as you mentioned before with the exercise, there's really no harm in these things. And so it's, even if we can't definitively prove that one causes the other, we know there's that relationship and it is good for people and people enjoy it. And so really, we would still encourage people to do it.
Well, you just teased a couple more of your six main pillars of prevention, socialization being one of them, a good social connections. What do we know about that?
We know that we know that we're social creatures and that we are meant, for most of us, not everyone is, but for the majority of people, that we're meant to engage with others. And so we have plenty of these association studies where people who are actively engaged, whether it's adult activity centers or they volunteer or they're in social networks, those people that tend to report those activities also tend to perform better on testing and have slower changes over time when they're followed in a research institute.
That socialization, you mentioned another S word a few moments ago, stress. What's the role of stress in Alzheimer's?
Stress has more of a biochemical relationship. So when Stress isn't necessarily a bad thing, but when you have too long of stress, persistent stress without any clear ending, it really does raise our cortisol level. And cortisol and adrenaline, those are our fight and flight hormones. Too much cortisol actually leads to disruption in our blood vessel, wall strength, our metabolic system, too much blood sugar, and all of those things then can actually lead to changes in our brain, or at least have a relationship to brain changes. So stress is a very real negative effect, not only on our heart, but then really on our brain.
Now, this makes me think of what I hear about adverse childhood experiences, where, you know, kids might be experiencing a lot of stress or other problems early in life. Maybe those same kids don't have great access to healthy food or reliable sleep. Are there social interventions we could be doing to tackle some of these factors early in life for people?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the main aspects of Alzheimer's disease research is really social determinants of health, because we know that things that happen to you throughout your life course do end up playing a role in how your brain performs later on. And so being able, I would argue this is a public policy issue now. This is, we need to be able to provide more and do better for our communities earlier in life and in the middle of their life, so that later on when you retire, you are not one that has to face the consequences of dementia.
We're talking about Alzheimer's prevention with Dr. Nathaniel Chin from UW-Madison's Alzheimer's Disease Research Program. Let's go back to our callers now. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Okay, this might be a duplicate question because I'm asking about brainwave entrainment or neurofeedback. Is that helpful in reducing Alzheimer's?
So that's a very interesting question. And so brain training is something that is being done as sort of a treatment and a way of helping people. It may not necessarily relate directly to the proteins of Alzheimer's disease or the brain cells dying, but it is a way for our brains to compensate, to find strategies to rewire around an issue and be able to perform well. In the end, it isn't the brain change that's so bothersome to us, it's the symptoms that we experience. And so if we have ways and mechanisms that our brains can perform despite those changes, we wouldn't worry so much about Alzheimer's disease.
Susan, thanks a lot for the question. Dr. Chin, I wanted to take a couple minutes to talk about your podcast, Dementia Matters, an opportunity for people to learn a lot more, I think, about Alzheimer's. What kind of things are you doing there?
Well, so it's meant to be for the general public, for the community, and the focus has been to translate some of the key research findings happening here at UW, but all across the world, really, by meeting with the researchers themselves, asking them questions, and helping them explain to the public what it is that we're doing within this research world. What are the findings? Why does this matter to us? You know, why are things taking either fast or slow as far as those results? The other aspect is really about caregivers and being able to provide information to people who are caring for a loved one living with dementia or cognitive change, or for the individual who's living with those changes.
I know there are a lot of paths to trying to tackle issues related to Alzheimer's, Dr. Chin. Is there something you're looking at that you feel the most optimistic about on the horizon?
I really do think with our advancement in identifying the changes of Alzheimer's disease, so these are when people talk about PET scans and these blood tests, our ability to identify people earlier and earlier in the disease is going to afford us the opportunity for earlier interventions and change. So along with prevention, along with these lifestyle habits, if we are going to have therapies, having those as early as possible, I do believe will lead to more meaningful outcomes. And our center here at UW is one of the cutting edge ones in identifying those changes in healthy people, but also in people who are experiencing symptoms.
And Dr. Chin, can you leave with some encouragement to tackle some of these lifestyle behaviors that can help reduce the risk of Alzheimer's?
I would recommend for people, pick one thing to start with. This is not going to be a sprint. This is a marathon, and you have to take it slowly. I don't want people getting injured. So pick one activity that is meaningful to you that you think you can start doing, and go with that. And as you get confident with that, then you can start taking on some of these other health habits. But certainly, exercise and sleep are ones that are going to have a benefit to you, regardless of your thinking ability, that you're going to notice on a day-to-day level.
Dr. Chin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nathaniel Chin is a geriatrician and the medical director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Program at UW-Madison. He's also host of the Dementia Matters podcast. We talked to him today about what we can do to lower our risk of getting Alzheimer's.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show, Monday at 7:30. State Capitol reporter Laurel White tells us what's in the budget passed by lawmakers and what happens now that it's in the hands of Governor Evers. That's Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a political reporter shares the key takeaways from President Biden's visit to La Crosse earlier this week. Remember, you can follow all these conversations and go into our archives as well by downloading the WPR app onto your phone or listen online at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time.